This is the first lecture in the module ethical argumentation. I've called it ethical argumentation and moral reasoning. Two sides of the same matter, so to speak. And this is basically an online course, but today I'll give a short introduction to the topic of ethical argumentation, and then and I'll also introduce some of our online resources and give you an idea of how we're going to work with this. So this is a short presentation, some slides on the very topic of ethical argumentation. Yes. There are basically three basic forms, there should have been three basic forms of moral reasoning, and I'll go through each of them briefly and introduce how you can reason in moral matters, what kind of ethical argumentation you can think of. These three basic kinds of reasonings are reasoning from virtue, reasoning from rules, and reasoning from consequences. At least this is a very common way of presenting the most important kinds of moral reasoning. And let's say a bit about each of them. The first idea is reasoning from virtue. Sometimes it's also called ontological reasoning. And this means that in my life I should focus on my ethical character and general behavior. So it's not as much something about the actual acts, it's more of me as a person. So the idea is that in order to do good things, you should be a good person. So it's more important to concentrate on you as a person than on what you actually do. This is a very old idea, and as many other things, it goes back to the old Greeks, Aristotle, for instance. But it has also meant a lot in Christian thinking in Europe, and it's Christian would be able to say tell more about that. But it is thought to be an important interpretation of New Testament. That you should develop or have virtues, and the virtues will grow in a person as fruits on a tree or something like that. It's an idea which is very old, and so the reasoning should concentrate on the person as such. Sometimes you speak about the cardinal virtues, and here some of them are listed, and sometimes more, you'll get up to 10 virtues, but the idea is you should concentrate on who you are, and it's more important that being good than doing good. this has also some influence in in the discussion of design, it sometimes says that designers their attitudes should be responsible, and they should act from these basic virtues, and that way they can be praiseworthy in what they're doing. So there's a design ethical aspect of that. You can also, of course, ask the question about the attitude and the general behavior of the designer. So if you use this as the basis of your reasoning, you would say something like this: that here are two premises. The major premise is: I aspire to be an honest person. I hate being a thief. Taking this necklace, I use this. I don't know if you feel like stealing this, but it's a very simple example I'm using. Of course, we all think that it's wrong to steal anything, including that necklace. And why shouldn't we do that? And in this kind of reasoning from virtue would say that I want to be an honest person, and I hate the idea of being a thief. Taking this necklace makes me a thief, therefore I should not take this necklace. So here again, we're concentrating on who we are rather than what we're actually doing. This is one kind of argumentation, ethical argumentation. Let's now move on to another kind of argumentation, which is even more famous and also used often in philosophy and theology. Here again, we are on our way to argue that it's wrong to steal. It's wrong to take this necklace. Why shouldn't you do it? Well, you shouldn't do it because there's a commandment: thou shalt not steal, one of the Ten Commandments. So the idea here is that you have a number of rules or commandments or standards you want to follow. And they have been written, or they have been transferred from one generation to another. So the basic concept here is not the person as we had before. Now we concentrate on a set of rules. So ethics is about, if you take this approach, ethics is about a set of rules or commandments or whatever. This is something which is not only used in philosophy and theology. It's also something, of course, lawyers and people who are studying law would like to use. Would be their approach. So they simply list a number of things you should follow, and being ethical is simply to follow this list of commandments or rules. So of course there's a long tradition again for that, having a set of rules or commandments. We all know the Ten Commandments, for instance: thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not kill, and so on. Or sometimes you can find rules or commandments that are at a higher level, so to speak, able to include a number of other commandments. The idea, the golden rule, love thy, love your neighbor as yourself, is supposed to be a rule at an upper level, which can include many other rules. And of course, that is what we find in the New Testament, for instance, that all the Ten Commandments are included in this more general statement: love your neighbor as yourself. Of course, you can ask the question: what is the relation between ethical rules and rules in legal laws? Is that the same? could there be things that are ethically acceptable, but forbidden? Or could there be things that are not ethically acceptable, but allowed according to law? You could probably come up with some examples. Could you mention some? I'll put you on. You can now say something in Copenhagen if you want. could you give me some examples of things which is forbidden but morally acceptable?
Smoking weed, for example.
Pardon?
Smoking
weed. so you will see, according to your moral standard, that should be okay, but it's not allowed according to law.
I think it's a choice you make on your own, like you also drink alcohol, etc.
Yes. Could there be other examples?
It's a lot easier to find some that are not ethically acceptable, but
legitimate. We will take that later on.
Okay.
But could there be something which is forbidden but morally okay? Do you have any ideas in Copenhagen?
Bestiality.
What do you mean?
Like having sexual relation with an animal.
Ah. Aha. So
they live in Copenhagen.
You live in Copenhagen. He says, I don't know why he says that. So and in what sense could that be an example?
With bestiality, like it's okay with the law, but it's not morally correct.
You can hold that it's So this is not forbidden, but it's that would be.
It could go the other way around.
That's an example of something which is legally acceptable.
Yeah, but it could go the other way around too. Like people could have the moral thing with it being okay, but it's illegal.
Hmm. Yeah.
As we say in Denmark, arbeid i sort is in many circles morally acceptable.
Another example of something which is forbidden but which could be considered acceptable would be something in traffic. I mean, I live in Vespia, and there's a long very flat roads, and there are no sideways. And if I drive at a speed of 81 kilometers an hour, I will be doing something which is actually forbidden. But there are some people, me perhaps, who would say that 81 is not morally wrong. But if I'm caught, I will have to accept that I'm doing something which is forbidden. So that is the one way around it. Could there be something which is allowed according to law, but morally wrong? You have already given one example. Could you give other examples of that?
With drones.
Say it again.
Warfare with drones.
Drones.
When
warfare.
Yeah.
Warfare.
Yeah, with drones.
And explain why that's an example.
Because it's unethical to send robots into war.
Mm-hmm. You think so?
And I also think that war is an unethical thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But it's legal for a country to declare war.
Yeah. What about I accept that example. It's nice. What about telling a lie to a friend or to a neighbor? that's not it's not forbidden, but it's morally problematic. Could be in some cases at least. Of course, you're not allowed to lie in court, but in general, there's no rule against lying. Okay, so we are actually speaking about two different systems, one in law and one in ethics. We cannot be sure that these two systems of rules actually the other way also. We can be certain that these two sets of rules give different results. It's not the case that one of them is included in the other. They are different. So we speak about ethical argumentation. And we cannot be certain that this will be the same as argumentation according to law. On the other hand, we all believe that the laws are somehow ethically inspired. So the relation between lawful argumentation and ethical argumentation is somewhat tricky and interesting. When we stick to the ethical argumentation, yes.
You know, we are having some problems with the sound. It's going away sometimes.
Is it better now? Should I mute it here?
Yeah.
Is this better?
Connection and a problem. So, yeah. But
I'll try to mute it and. Wave me if this is better when I mute. I have now muted the. Is this better? Okay. Thank you. Yes. one of the persons who have worked a lot with ethical rules is Immanuel Kant. Is probably. Is seen as the most important philosopher in the field, and he has introduced what has been called the categorical imperative, and actually there are five versions of that rule, and I'm not going to go through all these versions, but he argues that they are equivalent, the five versions. And basically, they are equivalent with the golden rule that you should love your neighbor as yourself, or you should treat others as you wish to be treated, something like that. Another person who has worked with logic. And argumentation is Ian Pryor, and He was one of the founders of the what is called deontological ethics, or the logic of obligation. And he claimed that in principle it should be possible to describe ethics in fully in terms of logic. At least if you can be sure that you can describe the actual situation fully, and you have all the rules available, then you can reason what you ought to do. The problem is that none of these two conditions are fulfilled. We will never have a complete description of our situation. There will always be a number of things we don't know. And and the other condition is also problematic. We will never know all the relevant rules. There will always be more to learn. So these two conditions will not be fulfilled. So we have to do with something less. Pryor worked with the formalization of this in logic, and he did interesting things, and this is something people are now using in details when they want to implement rules in machines. You mentioned robots a moment ago, and we may want to give a machine or a robot an ability to reason ethically, and in order to do that, you have to formalize ethics. So many people are trying to do that as part of an artificial intelligence project right now, and you've been discussing artificial intelligence and cyborgs and all that with David, and there's also an ethical component and question involved here. We may want to also to implement ethical argumentation in artificial intelligence and robots. At least many want to do that. As I said, these two conditions, a complete description of the actual situation and a complete description of all the relevant moral rules would be needed, and these two conditions are never fulfilled. And Pryor knew that, so the conclusion here is that if we want to do ethical argumentation, we have to realize that we will always be in a situation where we have to deal with an incomplete knowledge, and there will be open questions, and we have to make assumptions, and maybe these assumptions don't hold, but that's what we have to live with. There's another problem related to this way of seeing deontological reasoning or ethical argumentation, and that is the so-called dilemmas. And what is a dilemma? A dilemma occurs whenever two rules give different results. One example is that let's assume that we have hidden some Jews in the attic during the Second World War, and Gestapo is asking at the door whether we have people, Jews, in the house. So here are two rules, of course. One rule is you should not lie. Another rule is that you should protect your fellow human beings, your friends, and those who are in your protection. So here we have two rules and giving different results. Of course, if you want to follow the rule that you should not lie, we will have to tell the Gestapo that yes, they are in the attic. And if we want to protect our guests in the attic, then we have to lie. So there are many examples. So this is a standard problem in ethical argumentation. If you follow this deontological view, then you have to deal with the dilemmas. There are many of the kinds. So I've now spoken about two kinds of reasoning. One reasoning from the attitude or from who you are as a person, argumentation from virtue, and one from rules. Ethics is a set of rules. Now we come to the third idea, the third way of argumentation. In that case, you would like to reason from consequences. And the basic question is here: what is the consequence of a possible action, possible act? And let us go back to this very simple example of stealing the necklace. What would be the consequence of stealing this necklace? Yes, of course, if everybody took objects that don't belong to them, then all trust and institutions would break down, so to speak. There would be a number of consequences. This would be one, and there would be other consequences. And these consequences would be horrible, not only for society, but also for the individuals. So because of the consequences, we should not follow this temptation to steal a necklace, if there is such a temptation. Hopefully you can see that this kind of reasoning is different from the two others. This is sometimes called consequentialism or utilitarianism. In principle, there could be other kinds of consequentialism that utilitarianism, but utilitarianism is the most common, and it goes back to John Stuart Mill. At least he is often mentioned as one of the key thinkers in the fields. Of course, there were others even before him, but he is very famous in the fields. And his idea is that whenever you should choose between, and you have to make a choice between two or more possibilities, you should consider the consequences of each of the possibilities, and you should ask yourself which of the possibilities that lead to the greatest happiness, to the greatest numbers of persons in society. So you should actually calculate the amount of happiness. that comes out of possibility one and possibility two, and you should choose the possibility that leads to the highest degree of happiness in society. There are many problems related to this, and of course John Stuart Mill was aware of that, and he tried to deal with how this should be understood. One problem is how, in what units should we measure happiness? How can we do that? It's not simple. Some people who are working in this field would actually involve economical units here, try to translate happiness into money, and this is a serious way of doing it, and there are people who work that way. Others say this is too vulgar. They would like to use other standards, other units of pleasure. It could be a good year. Well, how many good years will that lead to for how many people? That has often been suggested. But at least the problem of measuring and the choice of units is certainly very complicated if you want to go into consequentialism. Another problem in this kind of reasoning is that it's not clear how many you should include in the calculation, even if you could do the calculation of the consequences. You'll have to decide who should be part of the calculation. Should it be everybody I know? Maybe only myself, and then it's called egoism. It could also be my family, or it could be everybody in Denmark, or everybody in Europe, and everybody in the whole world. And what about the animals? Will they also be part of it? And should they go into the calculation with the same weight as a human being? And if not, what weight should we give them if they are part of the calculation? This can easily be very complicated. As I see it, if we turn to B.J. Fox's book and his way of treating ethics, it is sort of a combination of a rule-based and a consequentialism approach he's using. And this is a diagram from the book, and I'm sure you've seen that before. And here, one of my reasons for saying that this is consequence oriented is that we start with the outcome. What is the outcome of what I'm doing? But there are also parts of his reasoning that are clearly rule based. Pryor has, he belongs to the Kantian tradition, and he sees ethical argumentation as closely related to rules and so on. He has criticized the idea of consequentialism in a number of considerations, and one problem is that he has argued that you can never calculate the total consequences of what you're doing. It's it's an impossible notion. Here I've made this idea of total consequences red. So this is a statement from Pryor, and the idea is that there is no such thing as a total consequence. It's an impossible notion. And he uses this very famous example. I think it's a children's poem. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. And for want of a rider, the battle was lost. And for want of the battle, the kingdom was lost. And for the want of the horseshoe nail. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So this begins with a horseshoe nail, and the total consequence of that, if we accept this notion, would be that the kingdom is lost. But it is ridiculous to see the lost kingdom as a consequence of a missing nail in a horseshoe. Another reason why we should not go into this idea of accepting calculations as the basis of ethics is that we cannot know what people will do in the future, because if we believe that they are to some extent free. So of course there is some, we could speak about what they probably will do, but we will never know what they would freely do. According to Pryor, so also for that reason, it's the calculation is not possible, not even in principle. There are other kinds of criticism of the consequentialism. Here's one famous criticism by Bernard Williams. It's about 20 innocent prisoners about to be executed, and then the captor says to Jim that if Jim will shoot one of the prisoners, then the rest of them will go free. What should Jim do? Of course, Bernard Williams would say that if Jim is arguing from a consequential or utilitarian point of view, he would say that of course, if I accept and actually shoot one of the prisoners, then 19 will go free. Then the consequences of this act will be better than if I don't do anything, because 20 lives will be lost. If you're not a consequentialist, but if you want to reason from the other points of view, if you reason from virtue, I'm not a killer and I don't want to be a killer. That could be one. Then you could say, of course, I won't do it for that reason. Of course, you could also say that I want to rescue my fellow human beings, and I want to be their savior, and then therefore I want to do it. So it's not easy what a person arguing from virtue would say, and also it's not easy to say what a Kantian ethicist would say. What would he say? Well, he would say, "Well, there are some rules here. You should rescue your fellow human beings, and also the other principles. You should not kill. That would be a basic rule. So he would be placed in a dilemma, and he would have to live with that or to act based on the dilemma if you can that. But this is a very famous example. So I hope that you understand the three kinds of a reasoning, argumentation. So who is right? Well, here comes my own position. As I see it, they're all right, and they're all wrong. If you consider ethics, then it will be terrible not to look at the consequences. Of course, you should ask the question: What will happen if I steal that necklace or whatever I'm tempted to do? You should, of course, consider the consequences of the act you are planning to carry out. And of course, there are rules. You should stick to principles. It makes sense to speak about rules of obligations, and we have to consider some principles we live by. So that is obvious. So we have the rules and we have the consequences, and they are of course part of the business. But they're more to the ethical question than utilitarianism and deontology. We also have to analyze the situation, who we are, and what is at stake, and the whole situation and the complex of what we're dealing with. So there are at least three main ideas that should be involved in according to my view in ethical argumentation. Okay, we have to involve the consequences and rules and principles. We also have to involve the ontological analysis of the concrete situation I'm in, the circumstances, and also, of course, my own person and who I want to be, and my history, and so on. So it is a very difficult combination of these three aspects, and there are many ethical questions we could discuss. Some of them have to do with informed consent, and I've listed other here about flying robots and so on. The main question we will consider in this course, we will concentrate on ethical questions concerning data collection and in particular we want to concentrate on privacy, on private data and the protection of privacy. this is a key question. There are all sorts of questions and discussions going on about surveillance in our private homes, domotics as it's sometimes called, and healthcare. And in metadata, many people are speaking about big data and so on. So And there are many, many, many ethical problems related to that. And that is the key example we're going to take in this this course. And all such problems can be dealt with from the perspectives I mentioned, virtues, my own hope to obtain a virtue or to keep it, and the rules and the consequences. All three aspects can be involved in the discussion of all these examples. What we're actually going to do in the course is that we'll go through a number of discussion in discussions in this discussions regarding these ethical matters, and some of it has already been presented. And I have actually I hope you remember the day we had in Nordkraft, and all that is now available online, and we'll consider that as part of the course. In addition, there is a lecture by Anne Gerdes from University of Southern Denmark on privacy, and we'll also have a lecture, a guest lecture from Søren Holm, who is a professor of medical ethics. He will speak about protection of data in healthcare, and he will come on March 6 and give a lecture here in this course. What I will do in the course is that I'll each Monday suggest some readings, and sometimes we will meet, but at other times we will just use the material, and you will know that from week to week. And there's of course a long reading list, so that's the idea. And we will end by the end of March, and then there will be a 3-day exam, and you will be asked to write an essay in Danish or English, as you wish, on an ethical problem related to privacy and data. Yes. Any questions? So this is the introduction to the area, and we will go on. Are you with us in Copenhagen?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah. Have you any question? Have you got any questions? No.
No, not really.
Okay. Yes, but we will soon have the Moodle presentation available, and I hope that you will go into the slides again, and I will send you the link also to this. Maybe you can also take it from here. The link to the material we have got.
Yeah.
So you, but you have, you don't have to work with all of it right away. You should take it step by step, and I'll suggest what you do each week. But the first step, I think, should be to ponder on the three kinds of reasoning. It's sort of the theoretical basis of what we're doing. Okay. Thank you. That's it. If you don't have questions, we'll stop here.
Okay.
A short break.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
So welcome to the second lecture about design of information architecture. This course at eighth semester at the education You probably remember that I just mentioned some things about this course last Monday after the exams, but now we are going a bit further into it, and I'd like you also to get acquainted with some of the material that is here. First of all, yeah, what is information architecture? You have this huge library. It's so beautiful. As far as I remember, it's from Dublin, from Trinity College in Dublin. You have this barrel-shaped vault ceiling, and then you have all the books down here. And this kind of organization is a classic way of designing information architecture. You could go alphabetically. You could go through some kind of categorization related to subjects. But you could also do like this, that you take the nice books and put those in front, and the ugly books you put in the back. It will be quite a different messages you send, however you categorize and how you design your information architecture. There are also some tools in this piece of information architecture. There's a ladder somewhere. You can pull it so you can get up and get the books that are close to the ceiling. There are several stories here, so there should also be a staircase somewhere. You'd also need some light to be able to read when it's a bit dark. And then, of course, you also have the aesthetic aspects of the information architecture design. You can see the sculptures of dead men, and you also have the beautiful ceiling. So altogether, you will say that this is a library, but it's not just a library because of each of the parts in it. It's a library because of the how all those different aspects are put together. There could also be some other dynamics in this. For instance, if you call it a library, it could be a private or a public library, but judging from the size, you would probably expect this to be a public library. And if it's public, it will must be open for the public in some sense at some periods of time, or it may be like this, that you will be able to ask to get access to some of the content. So there could be a lot of possibilities. And now at this course, you are going to design information architecture. Or as it is, you don't have to design is a sense that it's a working copy, but it's something that should in fact constitute a full system for doing something, for contributing with something to the world. So, yeah, what are you building? One guy was building a cathedral, another guy was driving the wheelbarrow in this picture about the this story about the building of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And information architecture should be watched as building cathedrals. But the challenge is that cathedrals need a lot of barrels to be pushed, wheelbarrows to be pushed, and along the way you may it may happen that you lose the overview of what you are actually doing. As an information architect, you need to be able to understand both the small steps and the big steps and the full picture of what is being constructed. So that's also something you will have to show in at the end of this course description. The module will introduce students to design of ICT and IA directed towards organizational practice or another professional practice. The module comprises teaching within the following areas: system design with particular emphasis on interaction design, user-driven system development and system development methods in theory and practice, and formal models for preparing and communicating design solutions, for example, blueprints, UML, etc. And it's important that you get to use these tools. The seventh semester, you had a lot of teaching on analysis of digital systems, and you could analyze it in different ways. You could find advantages and disadvantages of a specific system. But now you're moving a bit further. You're not just looking, you also get to design. You also get to, if not build yourself, then to be able to devise for other people what they should build and how they should do it. This leads to the exam, and I'll just mention this now because it's at seventh semester there were some exams. There'll also be some exams at eighth semester, and it's nice kind of to get an overview of what is expected from you already now. 3-day internal test, 10 pages, and since I will be the one giving you the test, then I can already now inform you that it will be centered around some kind of development, some kind of design project. You'll get that as a task in your test, to design something, and then part of the test will also be commenting on the different design steps in making the designs, design, and also commenting on different important areas of the design that you are producing. So it won't be all practical, but it will, as I see it, at least now, it should be a combination of a blueprint or UML, and also some kind of text that explains what is your system design. So I hope that makes sense, that it will be the 3-day test will be a little bit more practical than it may be in some of the other subjects, but still it will require the academic insight and the readings that that are obligatory in this course. Course literature, yes. Introduction to the course have a deliverable from the Europlot project, and I'll present that to you in a little while, and also one paper from Sandra Buregram Hansen, who you met at as censor at your exam. There are also a number of other books, and there will be commented on those along the way. I can't guarantee you that it will totally be in the same way that it is presented here with the course literature. So you should begin finding the stuff. And as I see it, everything of this should be, you should be able to find it online on AUB, or I have some digital copies of some of the articles that are not easily accessible from there, and I'll share it with you on Moodle. So that means that that hopefully you won't have to spend any money getting this literature. I hope you like that. Along the way, you will also get to learn UML, Unified Modeling Language, because it is really relevant for you, both for the exam and also for perhaps for the projects you are going into in the ninth semester, where you will have some internship possibilities. It will be nice for you to have a good tool to work with your information architecture decisions. So UML is something we'll work with later in the course, and perhaps I'll even make some kind of small preliminary test where you can try out UML before the actual exam. That could also be helpful for you, I believe. As I mentioned last Monday, you can see that the teaching you have received on ontologies may give you some valuable experiences in relation to how to interpret these diagrams and how to build them along the way. But now we'll move into something more fun. Now you can see how tough academia can be. This is pictures from the Europlot conference in Cyprus in 2013. Very nice place, Cyprus. We have a beautiful picture from the beach of Larnaca, taken by me on sitting on a sailboat, sailing out into the sunsets with a lot of half-drunk Russians, but very nice people. They shared their champagne. And you can also a picture of the tough academic work where you see Peter Erström working diligently with discourses of all kinds and a cup of coffee. You see the Mediterranean in the back, and those are the things you have to suffer in order to get higher academic degrees and do research. So I hope you respect us for having done that. The reason why I show you these pictures is, of course, not to make you envious, but because it's closely related to the Europlot. project. And Europlot project is a project that both Peter Ostrom and I participated in together with other people, Sandra also, and some of the output of Europlot I intend to use as examples for you in your course about the design of information architecture. I'll just skip into a PDF file now. You have the Iweplet, IWEPLET 2013 proceedings here. And Europlot was a research project that ended in 2013. It was supported by EU through their lifelong learning program, and PLOT stands for Persuasive Learning Objects Technologies. The point of departure of the Europlot project was some academics in Aalborg, in Austria, in Czech Republic, in Great Britain, and on Zealand, Hørsholm, who thought that perhaps we could benefit from implementing persuasive design thoughts in relation to teaching of different kinds in different subjects. And here are quite a numbers of the partners: the Aalborg University, DHI, University of Hradec-Králové, Donau Universitet, Leeds Metropolitan, and London Metropolitan Universities. We can just go into the website. There's a website for this, eplot.eu, which does not lead me where I thought I should be. This was better. Just you needed three W's in front. The Europlot project talks about learning objects ontologies are currently limited in their adaptability and how far they support active engagement from the learner. The Europlot project will develop a pedagogical framework for active engagement based on persuasive design and will demonstrate its value by creating offering tools for and examples of persuasive learning objects and technologies plots that are easy to create and adapt. So that was the point of departure in this research project, and that was what we worked at for several years. The case studies could be seen as learning situations where we could implement persuasive learning strategies, teaching strategies. They were quite different. One was the Kai Munk case, which you'll get to know a bit better. Kai Munk Danish theologian and playwright, lived 1898, yes, till 1944, where he was assassinated by the Germans outside of Silkeborg. And working with his production was one of the cases, the Kai Munk case. It has the subtitle archival work, but that was actually not what was fully intended with it. Then we had language learning in ancient Hebrew, which is something that you will often need in your daily life. How do I learn ancient Hebrew? Actually, for some people, it is something that you quite important. And Nikolai Winter Nielsen, who used to teach at this university, designed a system for helping people to understand Hebrew, which in the biblical Hebrew understanding is quite a dead language, which means that it has got other learning properties than, for instance, English, where you can go and speak it. That was one second case. We had the chemical exposure scenarios. What happens if you demix different chemicals? When do they blow? And what happens is there's some kind of risk for your health doing that. A company in Hørsholm worked with that. They needed learning materials for people who worked with chemical substances. Then we have a business computing case from Czech Republic and from Great Britain, where it was a kind of a limited area of business computing, a computer science module that people were supposed to learn better through the use of persuasive technologies. So you can see that Europlot actually consisted of a number of different cases, and those cases have been dealt with in different ways with the use of persuasive design approaches. That has also led to some discussions about the validity and the usefulness of persuasive design, but we'll go back to that. What is important for you right now to know is that I'll share the whole content of articles from the Europlot conference Iverplet with you, so that you have access to those different articles along the way. But at the website, there's also some more. There are some resources you can go and explore here, different things you can download, scenarios if you want to work with chemical substances, and yeah, a lot of different reports from this fairly large research project. Then there are also some webinars that you can listen to, and that could actually also be an interesting way of getting to know some of the things that happened at this research project. I can see that not all the webinars are there probably, but I think that most of them are. So here's something, and you can look at this project as a toolbox. You can look at it as a way of finding examples for something that you can use in your own work, in the sense that it's something that both Peter and I and Sandra, as it is, know quite a lot about. So let's get back to the slides again. Yes. So one of the things that you, one of the documents that you will get is also a deliverable 5.3. The deliverable, that's actually a report from the development partners in Aalborg to the EU system about what happens in the Europlot system. And it could be interesting in the sense that it presents some of the things that you may be exposed to during this course. Here is a picture of Kai Munk. It looks nice. Male pastors, they always look nice, almost always at least. But the content of the Kai Munk case involves obviously Kai Munk and his production, it could actually be exchanged into a lot of other contexts, because the diversity of the approaches to working with Kai Munk with a persuasive design approach could be transferred into other subjects that you want to work with. The first thing we have here is the Kai Munk study edition. Perhaps I should just find it for you to see. 1 second. At the Kai Munk Research Center, we have the web edition of the of Kai Munk's works here. We have a digitalized system. You could watch different texts, plays, sermons, journalism, prose, lyrics by Kai Munk. You could search in it. You could say, for instance, hope. You could search for that and you'll get a lot of hits in different genres. You could go in and see from where do these examples come from, different theatrical plays, for instance. So while that's one of the things that was developed during the Europlot system, though it's not altogether part of the research project, it was used in it in a lot of ways. So the Kai Munk study edition and the use of it. The conceptual pond. The conceptual pond is an interesting application used to collect response and input from people in. Yeah, it's will take a little while to explain that, but it is a way of assessing, a way of getting responses, getting answers, and we'll get back to that. You will meet that one of the other lectures in this course. Then there were some learning objects in Vidersø. Those were things that were created in relation to the Kai Munk Vicarage Museum. It was, for example, 3D pictures were photographed and used to put into a digital system so you could envision being in the actual building, though you were away in another part of the world. Then geocaching was also something what was researched in. Geocaching, you know what geocaching is? No. You're welcome to say something if you don't know what it is. Geocaching, it's a kind of system that was very popular at least some years ago. At a website you can find some the coordinates of a treasure. Means that you could go with your GPS system in your phone or something else, and you can go and find some kind of hidden box or something somewhere in the countryside. The geocaches, they were set out by Sandra Borgram Hansen and Lasse Borgram Hansen in the way that people, they could, on a walk in the Vidersø area, they could find the geocaches, and they could open the caches, and they could explore some kind of material regarding Kai Munk, which would make it more helpful for them, more interesting for them to be in the area. You could say the kind of simple enhancement of the experience of walking in the Vidersø area where the historical events about Kai Munk took place, many of them. Geocaches you could find all over Denmark, so if you go into to a search for geocaches on the web, you'll probably find a catalog of places where you can find it, and if you follow the instructions, follow the coordinates, you should be able to find quite a lot of stuff. Some places you take some kind of item that's left there, and you may also leave something new. For instance, take a coin and leave something else in the box. So there are a lot of possibilities in that. And the fifth part of the Kai Munk, the fifth main part of the Kai Munk case, had to do with mobile learning objects in Vesterhassing. Mobile learning objects were some of the digital objects that was planned to be developed in the Europlot project, and Sandra Borgram Hansen tried them out with a group of children in Vesterhassing, northern Jutland, and got some experiences in how did the kids and the mobile learning objects interact with each other. How did it actually work? I don't want to go much into that right now, but you can read it in the deliverable that will be put in the Moodle site when it's arranged. I think it will be open today or tomorrow. I hope it will be. We have asked it for it to be there. So, any questions to this? Something that you're wondering about? It may also be just the question why you get exposed to all of this.
Okay, why?
Why? It's actually to give you insight in a research program and the different aspects of it, how many different possibilities there are. These things are all related to digital systems, but in a lot of different ways. So this means that when you are yourself going to work with designing information architecture, then this could be inspiration that it could have a large variety of shapes. It could be quite simple and it could be very complex, and it could also work together with things that are actually not digital technology. For instance, the geocaches, the caches, they are not digital technology, but the device you use to find the caches is digital. And it could work together with other things. For instance, you could easily have it like this, that you download an app, and when you reach a certain geographical position, then the app unlocks new content, so you'll be able to see, for instance, a movie about what happened at exactly that time and at exactly that place. So that means that you'll get, as it was, worked with an enhanced learning experience.
If you made an information architecture of the geocaching, would you, in your information architecture, then have to say that when you are in this particular place, this has to be released?
No, then it would actually do it by itself.
Is it something you have to do in the information architecture, saying that? Like,
yeah.
If you go to this church or whatever, this will message will come up.
Yeah, that should be part of the information architecture. That you build. What are the possibilities? When you think about the Kairos concept we talk about, that's originally only deals with time, but now, as we see it, it deals also with both with time, the opportune moment, the opportune location, and the opportune manner. So that could mean that if you are at the right location, that will be also a Kairos trigger, you should call it, not trigger in the sense of BDFR, but trigger in the sense that in the system that would release new content. And it could be interesting to, when thinking about information architecture, you also have to, as Peter mentioned in his teaching about different kinds of time, that actually a system shouldn't be seen just as a stable creation, but something that would actually evolve over time, because if you move to another place, then the system has to adapt that you are in that place and at a different time. So the time kind of moves to the place where the content is released.
But information architecture is not interactive, it's static, right? If I use the program, the UML, and I made an information architecture in there, it's not interactive, it's more like an overview, right?
Yeah, but it still should say, an overview should still explain the possibilities that are there.
Yeah, sure, but it's not like doing anything. It's not interactive, even though if I explain it is.
No, that's the problem. If you make a UML file, for instance, that is, I don't know whether you can get it in a way that actually does.
But it was more just to clarify.
Yeah.
But
but you have to state the possibilities, for instance, that of course it will have it will have one way of being as it is, but if you move to another place, for instance, then the system will have another way of being. So it will change from one place to the other because there are those dynamics within it. I think it could be, let's see if we have it here, we have the branching time illustration that Peter used, that that things they will be needed, it will develop into different strings, different possibilities along the way. So that means that actually you could make a blueprint or an UML file, but in reality, because of the dynamics, then it could be far more complex. How about you in Copenhagen? Do you have any questions?
Did you silence?
No, we don't really have any questions so far.
Do you have any objections?
No, we don't have any objections.
No. Then let's take a 5 minutes break before we go on. Okay?
Yeah.